This is William Evans, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today is Paul Zack from Claremont, California. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Will.
20 years ago, you earned a PhD in economics at the University of Pennsylvania, and now among your titles, you're a professor of economics, psychology, and management at Claremont Graduate University. From your experience, what does a healthy economy need to function long-term?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it needs healthy people and healthy institutions. I think the sort of dirty secret of economics is that economic prosperity has very little to do with the things we typically think of, educational systems or taxes and this and that. It has to do really with individuals wanting to be happy. And when you allow people the freedom to make choices and provide an environment in which those choices, can be executed with reasonable certainty, then very naturally those countries produce happier people, and they become happier by investing in new ideas, by sending their kids to school, having fewer children, and investing more in those children. And then you have this sort of sustained ability to create prosperity. But I think, sometimes economics is called the dismal science because it's focused on measurement. I think it's really the happy science. It's the study of people making as good a choice as they can to be as happy as they can in their lives, subject to the constraints that they face. Those could be cognitive constraints. It could be constraints on where they live. But I think economics fundamentally is about happiness.
Well, that's a refreshing definition of economics. At the end of my medical career, I understand the health tragedy of our time to be disconnection. And I've come to realize this is a forgetting about our creativity and our connectivity.
Right. So we looked at connection in many ways, as you know, in our laboratory research. And, the punchline from that is we are a connecting species, and we'll find any way that we can to connect to others. And one of the unique things about human beings is that we will connect with strangers very rapidly. You just toss a couple people in a room, and all of a sudden they're chatting away. Almost always, right? There's some exceptions. There's some, maybe unstable people there, or people who, maybe perceived as dangerous or something. But for the most part, think of a plane ride, right? You start chatting with your seatmate, and for many people, that's a sort of moderately stressful situation, flying through the sky at 600 miles an hour, and we still chat. So I think that's an amazing thing. So I agree with you. I think the connection is so important for people.
What's the role of trust in connecting?
Trust is like the sort of on-off switch, right? If I don't trust you, then I'm not going to open up to you cognitively, emotionally, and allow myself to share anything more than hi and bye. So kind of bringing back to your first question, I had shown in research published in the late 90s that among the strongest predictors economists had ever found to understand why some countries are prosperous and some are poor was the role of trust. So high trust countries have more social interactions, and more social interactions lead to economic transactions that are able to sustain prosperity. So the next question was, what does that switch look like neurologically? And we spent a lot of years really characterizing particular neurochemicals and brain circuits that seem to tell us quite rapidly and unconsciously who is safe to be around and who's not. And if I judge you to be safe in this imperfect and blunt system in the brain, then I'm likely to connect to you. So trust is the precursor.
And so it's accurate to say that the vast majority of people have the ability to connect and trust.
That's right. So we've tested now thousands and thousands of people using a series of blood tests to look at the release of this neurochemical oxytocin, which seems to be this key trust indicator in the brain. And of those thousands of people, about 95% have an intact oxytocin system. That is, after a positive social interaction, their brains release oxytocin, and that signaling molecule in the brain tells them it's okay to connect. So I guess the big question then is, who are those 5% who don't get this? A couple percent, 1 or 2% of those are people having a really bad day. So we all know this. If you're having a bad day, your dog died, you got in a car accident, you're not the nicest person, and high levels of stress inhibit the brain's synthesis of oxytocin. You're kind of in survival mode, and so you're not really in reaching out and connecting mode generally. Although a little bit of stress actually motivates us to connect more, high stress doesn't. The second is we found about 2% of the free-roaming humans we've tested have many of the traits of psychopaths. And in some detailed studies we've done in criminal psychopaths, we find on average the system doesn't work properly in them. And then the last group, about 1%, are individuals who have generally very severe histories of abuse or abandonment, particularly as children. And so the brain tends not to set up pathways for behaviors that don't seem to be useful for you. So if you're not getting nurturing from mom and dad or some caretaker, then often these nurturing pathways utilizing oxytocin do not develop properly. So we've shown this in, for example, in studies of sexually abused women. And about half those, actually, I should say, about half those sexually abused women we've studied, still moderate sample size, but other people have done this as well, about half of them do have an intact oxytocin connection system, and about half don't. And the extent and degree of abuse do not predict who will be resilient to it in terms of this brain system. Other factors, genetic factors and social support, seem to predict that.
So at the local level, is trust alive and well in America today?
That's a great question. I mean, if you look at the survey data, you would say no. So secular trust level, so I should sort of back up and define that term. So by trust here, we mean generalized trust. So that is, if I pull two people from the U.S., and I ask them, do you think this person in front of you is trustworthy? They would say yes. So it's the generalized trust that works as this sort of social lubricant that allows us to all to kind of get along without having, a policeman or a lawyer on every corner telling us what we can do and can't do.
And make economic exchanges.
And make economic exchanges as well, correct. So generalized trust in the U.S. has had a very strong secular trend downward from a high in the mid-60s. 67, 68 trust in the U.S. peaked, according to surveys. About 60% of the people said, yes, I trust other Americans. The number is down now to about 35% of Americans say they trust each other.
Well, I saw that in your book, Paul, and I was very intrigued by it. So I looked at what I could find, and some of that is related to the government and corporations rather than individual.
It is. So that's why we should take this with just a grain of salt. So if you look at trust in this smaller setting, not just generalized trust, but the people in my community, or,
right.
For example, my representative in Congress versus Congress in general, actually you do see trust sustained at much higher levels, and perhaps not surprisingly, for example, in smaller towns, trust is higher. Yes, you know more people, you're more connected. In larger places like New York or L.A. or Chicago, trust tends to be lower. It's more anonymous. And so I think, connecting is about recognizing others, recognizing people who seem to be safe to interact with. And I think that's easier when you have a little more intimate interactions with those around you.
Sure.
It's not impossible in New York. It just takes a little more work, I think.
And I think it's helpful to also know who you've had experiences with that make you cautious.
For sure. And I should say oxytocin is not kind of a 0 to 100 variable. It's not like when your brain makes oxytocin, you go from being suspicious to being, handing your wallet to strangers. We're constantly trying to balance the appropriate levels of trust and distrust for the people we interact with. I mean, even with people in our families that we love, right? If your wife comes home with, tousled hair and, smells like men's cologne, yeah, you ought to investigate that. That would be quite odd, or the husband comes home with lipstick on the collar, right? So, we're constantly trying to balance the appropriate levels of trust and distrust, and certainly for people we meet on the street, we're doing that. So oxytocin is just one of those factors that helps maintain, I think we could say, a healthy balance between trust and distrust.
Yeah, just thinking about myself, when I don't have that feeling and I don't have the sense my oxytocin is flowing, I'm much more cautious. But when I get to my hometown, I'm relaxed, I know people, and I'm continually reinforced by that connectivity.
So should we tell the listeners our secret? So when we met in Aspen some months ago, I did a brain hack on you to make your brain release oxytocin. I gave you a hug.
Right.
And so for many, many years now, I have refused to shake hands with people, and I hug them instead, because we've shown that touch releases oxytocin. So, you know, I think we are constantly, manipulating other people's brains, consciously or unconsciously. So, you know, that's a conscious manipulation, because I want to connect to people. I want them to see me as safe and trustworthy. And, the conversations you get to, you get to the interesting points a lot faster when you've hugged someone. So it's a very odd thing. I think it reveals our deeply social nature as human beings, that we need connection, we need touch, and we need that emotional response. So, as you know, because we've spoken, at length, what oxytocin does to you psychologically is it increases your sense of empathy. So now when I'm releasing oxytocin, I can understand you better emotionally, understand what your motivations are, how you're feeling, where you're likely to go with this conversation or do something. And that's very adaptive for social creatures. It's also very healthy, right? If we're not emotionally connecting to people around us, then, just saying hi to your neighbors, may not be enough.
What blocks oxytocin release?
Yes. So a variety of factors. One we discussed already, which is very high levels of stress. The second that we've investigated extensively are high levels of testosterone. So we've done experiments where we administer testosterone to men and compare their behavior to themselves on placebo. We find that testosterone only inhibits oxytocin. It therefore makes men more selfish, more entitled, as they demand more from others. So those are teenage boys, right? You and I used to be teenage boys a couple of years ago.
I remember what that was like.
But it turns out that if you win a chess match, your testosterone goes up. If you get a promotion at work, your testosterone goes up. And this happens for men and for women. So it is not surprising to me that we should see CEOs and presidents and prime ministers who are focused on themselves as the center of attention, or movie stars for that matter. It's all about them. It doesn't become about connecting. It becomes about as if testosterone whispers in your brain, you have the best genes on the planet. Everyone should bow down in front of you. Everyone should want to mate with you. You're on top of the heap, clearly, because, you're the CEO of this company. You're the president of this country. So, I think one thing we didn't talk about in our previous conversations was kind of being mindful of these, this soup of chemicals that our brain lives in that does affect our behavior. So I think we'll become a little more mindful of behaviors. Then we can use our nice big prefrontal cortices to say, I certainly feel like I'm entitled because, damn it, I run this company, but I need to actually suppress that because that's very off-putting to most people around me. And so if I behave in this kind of entitled manner, most people will be driven away from me. And, I don't think that's really what I want to do.
This is William Evans, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today is Paul Zak from the faculty of Claremont Graduate University. Paul is also on the faculty of the neurology department at Loma Linda Medical Center, and we're conversing about the role of trust in the hormone oxytocin and its relationship to prosperity for communities and for nations. So without a healthy presence of oxytocin in a population that's safe, the economy is going to drift toward greed and poverty.
I think that's correct, except in extreme cases. So we have done some cross-country tests on kind of what comes first. Do you sort of need a stable political legal environment to begin the process of generating prosperity, or do you need trust first? It looks like the oxytocin responds to the environment you're in, not the converse. So, there are places that often have very low levels of trust, like China, where you still get prosperity because you have enough structure, political legal structure, although an odd legal structure in China in many ways, in terms of property rights, for example. But you have a structure, you have enough certainty about what's going to happen, at least in the medium term, that allows people to make investments, start new businesses, you know, invent new products. So in the extreme cases, in sub-Saharan Africa, in some areas of the Middle East, that are very unstable, so that children grow up in not only extreme poverty, but with this kind of instability in which there's very little nurturing, child mortality is high, birth rates are high, and it's kind of in a dog-eat-dog world. That's the kind of extreme case in which, from the evidence we have, which is scant, clearly, that people in these countries really don't develop the neurologic ability to begin to trust others. That can be learned. It can be overcome. These systems are not non-malleable. If people from a very poor area, bring them to the U.S. or Europe, and they can adapt just fine. In other cases, they can't. I think one of the most telling cases from the book is orphans in the end of the communist era in Eastern Europe, for example, in Hungary, who were basically, kept in cribs and kept clean and fed, but were not nurtured, were not touched, were not cared for. And when some of those children were adopted into homes in the U.S., they really didn't seem to have the ability to connect to people around them. They couldn't very well overcome those deficits. So that's, kind of tragic.
Yeah, it's hugely tragic. We know from a lot of studies at the National Institute of Mental Health that touch is critical for healthy development. And touch is going to release oxytocin.
And it's hard to touch someone and not care about them. And I think that's what, that's why I give the hugs. But, and you can listen to someone and not pay attention to them. One of the things I like to tell people is listen with your eyes. Right? If I'm talking to you, don't look at your phone. Don't look at your computer screen. Give me your full attention. I'll give you my full attention. And then it's much easier to build that kind of connection and then move forward with whatever we're here talking about. Maybe we're just talking about baseball or movies, but still I'd like to give you that full attention. And I think it's both respectful, but also it's the ability to form that deeper connection than just some kind of trivial interaction.
Well, I certainly, and you do too, I'm sure, know immediately when somebody's touch doesn't feel good. And this is somebody to be aware of, or there's something else going on here we need to be cautious about.
Right. So for the hugs, what I do is I pre-announce. And so every once in a while, someone will say, I'm just not comfortable hugging. I say, oh, that's totally fine. I would, never force, touch on that. That's about 1% of the cases in my experience. And the other 99% just light up. And so, certainly inappropriate touch is bad and really abusive. But you'd be surprised, Will, how many, business meetings I go into in some big skyscraper in New York City, and people put their hand out, and I put my arms out, and I give them a hug, and they just light up.
Right.
And so I think it comes down to your core question, which is, what's so important, what's one of the most important things about human beings? That's the ability to connect. And hugging someone is a kind of vulnerability, and there's something very appealing about people who allow themselves to be vulnerable. So I don't think vulnerability is necessarily a bad thing. It's just showing someone who you are.
Yeah, I usually ask permission before I give someone a hug.
Yeah, part of it's age, right? So I'm a little bit younger than you, but I'm in my 50s, and I don't think I would be going around hugging everybody if I was 25 or something, but you have a little gray hair.
Yeah.
or a little missing hair, and you can get away with a little bit more.
You started to study trust as a slice of the larger domain of morality. Have you started to look at other areas yet, or are you still pretty much focused on trust in your research?
We have. So once we showed we did these experiments where people via computer could transfer money to each other And if they transferred money to a stranger, that money would grow in size, but then the stranger controlled it. And then the stranger could either share it back with the person who had sent the money or keep it all. This is a way to kind of quantify trust, but to take out that personal interaction that we normally have, partially because we ran these studies, like many studies, originally on university students, and we worried about the, quote, cute guy or girl effect, right? So imagine if the person in front of you is a cute guy or girl. Of course, you know, if they're attractive, you're going to treat them differently than someone you don't want to impress as much. So we use computers, and we found that even in this fairly depersonalized money transfer setting via computer, oxytocin was released. And so, yeah, then it leads to these other questions. You know, one is, you know, are there situations in real life, not these sort of scripted interactions in the lab, that release oxytocin? And so we began doing field studies, everything from weddings to folk dances, to churches, to the jungles of Papua New Guinea, which we had indigenous people dance and took their blood before and after. Basically, any social interaction we found induces the release of oxytocin. By the way, even interactions at a distance, you know, via the internet or from movies. Movies are great oxytocin releasers.
I bet.
So that was the first question. The second question was, you know, is it just trust or is it something more general? So what about situations in which I can only win if you lose, so I have to be altruistic? And it turns out oxytocin is released in almost all these kinds of situations. So it makes people more generous, as I said earlier, more empathic. Again, even at a distance, if we show you a short video, which we've done many times, of a little child dying of brain cancer, people's brains, almost everyone's brains, are just flooded with oxytocin, and they'll donate to a childhood cancer charity if they get this response. They really want to help. They want to connect to this little boy, even though, you know, he's already passed away. You know, they feel this sort of connection to the larger community of human beings. So I think oxytocin just sustains us in community. And so community, in many ways, is the source of moral behaviors. And this is moral with a small m. Right? In the book, you know, I certainly have no philosophical or theological axe to grind. But moral behaviors means those positive social behaviors that help sustain us in community. So being honest, being trustworthy, being kind. If you don't do these things, then people begin to avoid you, and then you're in a different world. But for most of us, we work pretty hard to keep ourselves in communities, and oxytocin seems to motivate those behaviors.
Have you done any studying that shows you the effect of people who are in fearful situations who are able to connect and still bring up their oxytocin in the presence of fear, and what's the benefit?
Yeah, great question. So fear, moderate fears, find the trust in the lab. We've done some of those studies. But we started thinking recently about extreme fear. And so I'm a super tall guy, and like all tall people, I have a fear of heights because my center of gravity is so high, I'm always falling over. And so we had this idea to go tandem, take me tandem skydiving. So it would be my own experimental subject.
All right.
And when I heard that idea from my lab, I thought, wow, oh, that's brilliant. We should definitely do that. And I can only do that to myself because I can't force anyone to do this, you know, scary task. And I took my blood before and after. And indeed, I was scared to death. My stress hormone cortisol went up 400%, but I still released oxytocin. Now, I've done this experiment three other times, so four times total tandem skydiving. And every time my stress response is lower and my oxytocin response is higher. The last time I went recently, I did this for a Japanese TV show, and I had a 200% increase in oxytocin. 200% is, you know,
now,
really am attached to my skydive instructor. I like him. He's great.
You went skydiving in Japan, too?
This was for a Japanese TV show that came here, but
filmed
you here. Now I kind of like it, and it cured my fear of heights, you know, in one shot. So when are we going to go skydiving together? That's the question, Will.
All right. Well, we better do it soon because I'm getting old and some of my joints don't work like they used to, Paul.
Okay. Yeah, I think, you know, we human beings are much better creatures than we give ourselves credit for many times. I think, you know, many, many times human beings do wonderful and beautiful things with each other. We should celebrate that and promote it. And, yeah, the bad behavior gets the press, but human beings I've discovered are a pretty interesting and nice species.
Great. Keep hugging.
There you go.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Will. What a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. This is William Evans. You've been listening to Shifting Gears. I've been conversing with Paul Zak about the economy and oxytocin. Thank you for listening.